listener production.
Shares. Market. The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips, and he is ultramarathon runner, ice climber, and freediver, Andrew Page. Mr. Page, good morning.
Yeah, ice climbing's a new one. I thought I'd challenge myself a bit more.
I'm impressed that you did that. That in freediving, mate. You're kind of rising to the heights. You're diving to the depths. Is there no extent you won't go to for wonderful physical health and maybe metaphorically for investment ideas as well?
No, my body is a temple, as you well know. And you got to put in the work, you know?
Yes, you do. Better you than me, mate. But I'm glad one of us is really challenging ourselves to be the best versions of ourselves we can be. Mate, how's your week been?
It's been really good, actually. Can I tell you, so personal anecdote, as you know, we got a house recently. It's got a little bit out of town. There's got a bit of lawn and I thought, I'll mow the lawn, right? And it's a ride-on mower. 3.5 hours later,
yeah,
I'm still doing, because it's huge. And then for the first 15 minutes, I'm doing this with the biggest grin on my face ever. Right? It's like, I don't know if it was the same when you first got your mower.
Yeah.
It was just like, I'm never going to get sick of this. This is fantastic.
Great.
You know, 2 hours later, it's like, oh, you're really old. I'm Googling robot vacuum, robot.
Oh, really? Okay.
Pretty cool stuff, actually. Can
I say, so here's what will happen. I have a ride on as well. You'll find that it's fun, then it gets old, then you realize, and my wife and son are not listening to this, you'll realize you actually then get some alone time with a podcast or some music or something. So all I'm saying is the curve will come back up when you realize that I get 3.5 hours to myself, I'm doing the lawns, it finishes, I look great, and I get some podcast time.
That's true. I can see that. The other thing is, I thought, you know, sometimes technology looks for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And here I am, I'm Googling robot mowers.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, and then I go for a walk around the block and the bloke across the road's got a bunch of sheep. And I thought, it's like NASA inventing the pen that writes in 0G and the Russians using the pencil,
yes,
kind of thing.
It's
like,
good point.
There's an elegant... You're going to buy like a goat or something.
That's right.
There we go.
You can buy a sheep, mate. You get some wool. You can knit a jumper and have your lawnmower at the same time.
Self-sufficient.
Exactly. That's very, very funny.
That was a long tangent, but you asked how my week was, and that was a highlight. So.
No, I like it. I'm not the response I expected, so I like that. I like that very much. Mate, we're going to do some mailbag questions. I'm going to take this one from our Facebook questions for the most part. Most of our emails come in via email, and so what happens is I end up doing those and not doing the other ones, and I get in trouble occasionally from some of our regular correspondents when I don't check my Twitter feed or my Facebook account for questions. So here goes some Facebook questions for today. Mate, this one's from Nick. Nick just starts off with, "Hey, Scott and Ram, and happy Easter. A question for the Poddington, if you'd be so kind." I have not heard it called the Poddington before, so I may adopt that, Nick, or I may just keep the old faithful pod machine. Come on, we all know which one I'm going to go on that one. Nick said, "I've just spent the Easter weekend with 30-ish extended family, and it's reminded me how few people know about, let alone understand, equity investing. Of course, the conversation turned to property multiple times, but any mention of shares simply stopped the conversation dead in its tracks."
Oh, Nick.
Now, well, here's what I like
feel
about
Nick's, you. I feel like your Nick's pain, question. Sir.
Nick says, "Why do you think it is that while so much of our media focuses on what equities are doing, so few of us actually know or care? Cheers, Nick." See, I reckon that's true, mate. I mean,
true.
I've been known to turn up occasionally on radio or TV, and someone asks me, "What do the All Ords do today?" So I give the answer. So, you know, people want to know, is it up or down or whatever? And I have made the point separately, and frankly, sometimes there, you know, a day's movements aren't that big a deal. But it is, you know, because it's there. So I say, to Nick's point, because it's there, we talk about it. But yet, when we talk about more than property, honestly, in that context, in terms of what's happening on the share market, but there's a real disconnect between that and investing, understanding, knowing about it. I have my suspicions, but what do you reckon, to Nick's question, why is it that more Australians don't know or care about investing in shares?
I mean, one, it's intimidating. Let's be honest. It is. It's evaluating a business is harder in a lot of ways than evaluating a property. It's more ethereal as well. Like, it's one of those my little bugbears. People say, oh, it's non-tangible. And, you know, I think, well, yes, these companies do exist in the world. You can go and touch Woolies and Commonwealth Bank. Like, they are real things. However,
property companies, literally people talk about property. There are property companies out there that do on an industrial scale what we do as property investors. If, I'm not an investor in property, but, you know, if you choose to buy an investment property, they're just doing that on a broader scale. Go on.
Yep. So property's easy. It's a pile of bricks on a patch of dirt, and I can probably charge some rent on it. Boom. bit of maintenance, bit of rates, bit of this, bit of that. It's just super, super, super easy. The other thing that is a really good thing, but most people see as a bad thing, is that the share markets are very liquid. And again, I just went through the incredibly annoying, painful process of buying a house. And it is the frictions, the costs, the time frame, you know, months of heartache, and just you want to, like, you know, bang your head against a wall versus open up my smartphone, press a button, and settle on a trade. but that liquidity comes at a cost, and the cost is volatility. The analogy I've always used, and it's a great one, it's not mine, but I forget who I stole it from, but, you know, if you had an auction at your house every weekend, you watch how volatile property becomes, right? You can imagine, like, that sometimes you'll get a lot of people turn up, everyone will be in a good mood, and the next weekend, not so much, and the value of your property could fluctuate by $200,000 in a week. Now, we don't see that, because the only time you really know the value of your property is when you sell it, when you buy it and when you sell it. And in between, so you get two data points and you go, started here, ended there, no volatility. And that volatility is just a consequence of not being traded. So my answer is, it's more complicated, although I'll come back to that, because I don't think it's as complicated as people make it out to be. And it's more volatile. And so, that is why and you've got a wonderful social proof over the last decade or two of property being an insanely good investment. You know, and it's sort of like, it's quote unquote low risk. It's quote unquote guaranteed. And I'm very deliberately putting quotes around here. And it's very easy to wrap my head around, and people are going to gravitate towards that. And by the way, these aren't weaknesses. People might be thinking, well, what is wrong with this picture? it's pretty good, right? Like, these are not necessarily bad things. That's my answer. I would say that the allure should be that, my retort to these kind of scenarios would be, it doesn't have to be complicated. You can buy an ETF and go fishing, right? Or do whatever you want to do. So it can be super, super, super easy. It's only volatile if you choose to look at it constantly. But the reason why you would put up with it is because what you get in compensation for that is superior returns. And again, this will annoy people. Well, actually, my property did. No, let's not talk about you, right? Because I can equally say, well, look at this 1 cent stock I bought 10 years ago and now it's $100. I mean, that's a spurious example. But on average, because people measure this stuff, it's published. You often refer to the to the Vanguard chart. Thank you. I was going to say S&P then for a second. It performs better. And it tends to perform better over the long run because of the risk involved. Risk equals return. No, I've got to be careful. I hate that saying. It's not risk equals return. Risk enables return. And so don't look at those things as negatives. If you're prepared to, like, go a tiny bit deeper than most other people, if you're prepared to wear a little bit of extra volatility, then yeah, it's going to be worthwhile. And if most people aren't going to be interested in that, that's cool. It's, you know, less competition. So let them have their fun wherever they want to have their fun and keep it to yourself.
That's very mercenary of you.
I long ago stopped trying to solve the problems of the world. It's all about me.
People listen to your Friday rant about.
Joking.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. No. I think you've pretty much nailed it, mate. I think we have limited capacity and willingness to take on different ideas as a species, because we don't have the brain power or the time to do it. And so what do we do? Well, we think, okay, well, what can I easily absorb that would solve most of the problem? That needs to be the case, right? Those heuristics need to be true. You talked about first principles on Friday. The reality is if we had to do everything for first principles, you'd never get out of bed.
No.
Right? Which muscle do I have to use in what order to get out of bed? You know, how do I clean my teeth? Which hand, up, down, back? The human body, we take shortcuts all the time. And if you think about property, right? So firstly, we all live in one. So we kind of feel like we understand it. We kind of do. It's a physical asset, as you say, mate. And as much as companies are physical things, generally speaking, plenty aren't. And the reality of property is it's going to be a more stable asset class because the houses, units don't go anywhere. It is a national total. The success of Woolies against Coles isn't necessarily the success of one property against another. They don't work the same way. Mm-hmm. You can't disrupt housing. I mean, I guess you could at some level, but you can't replace housing with something else. Until we all become heads in jars with living in the metaverse. It's physical. It's there. We all live in it. We've all paid rent or a mortgage or both. Frankly, the tax benefits are paramount for a lot of people. We all know someone or think we know someone who owns a property who can tell us it's a good idea. So the social proof you talked about, you kind of roll that together and say, well, it's natural that in that context, not preordained, but natural in the sense of the society that we live in, that's where we start, you know? And I think that's right. I think shares are difficult. You got to understand Woolworths, and you got to understand whether Woolworths is a good or a bad price to buy, and try and work that out. And that's harder for most people than property because of that volatility. Now,
well, people, I would argue that people don't even, not everyone. I'm generalizing here, but I would say people don't do any return calculations or assumptions or modeling on. It's just like goes up.
Yeah, that's true.
Why?
That's true.
It just does. Shoulder shrug, it does. And it's like it's taken as an element of religious faith at some point.
Yes. And I think not even conscious religious faith, it is presented so self-evident, it doesn't even require faith. It's almost better than faith in that sense of it always has everyone
self-evident.
Says it does. Right, exactly. And so, yeah, so why wouldn't I? Shares are harder. They are harder to get your head around. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't do the work, as Ram said, but they are harder. I think that's why. I think it's... I've said before on this podcast, my old man thought the share market was a casino. And I don't blame
most people. I'm crazy when I say that, money's in shares.
Like, and why? Yeah. Because you hear about the collapses. You hear about the market up and down, and up and down, up and down, up and down, and no one knows what's going on. It seems like unless you've made the effort and frankly had someone to help you, or hopefully helping our listeners now, help you understand it, I don't blame anyone. Had I not had a year 8, 9 economics teacher, Mr. Barnett, who literally, kids, there were newspapers once and the share price were only in the newspapers because the internet didn't exist. Yes, that's how old I am. We'd grab yesterday's Fin. We used to get student subscriptions to the Fin. That's how nerdy I was as a kid. Mm-hmm. And you could pay, whatever it was, $2 a week or something.
Shillings.
Shillings? You were lucky to have shillings. I had to use shells.
Bales of hay.
And you'd look it up and you'd run your line across. You'd say, well, worst code, WOW, PE ratio, price this, PE ratio, that, dividend yield this, and 52-week high and low. And that was about it. So you go, okay, well, that's where we're at. That's what we do. Which is a long way of saying, had I not had that explained to me at school, I don't know how my life might have been different, professionally or personally. I don't blame people for not understanding, not knowing, and frankly not having or feeling like they have the time or inclination to understand it, because it is presented as difficult and it is a bit harder than property. It just is, in terms of your ability to conceptualize what it is, what it does, how what's likely to go in the future. We've all seen businesses collapse. Godfrey's went broke a couple of weeks ago. You could have owned Godfrey shares or Woolly shares. Which one should you have bought? Why should you have bought it? How would you have thought about it? You don't have to do that with property, right? The whole market might do whatever it does. But Australians need housing. Australians live in housing. That housing is going to be there. Maybe it's worth a bit more. Maybe it's worth a bit less. Maybe rent's a bit lower, a bit higher. The range of outcomes is just much, much lower over any extended period of time than individual companies. And that's the only thing I would say about your example, mate, is you're right about people saying individual property versus individual shares. But frankly, ETFs are really new. Before that, you couldn't really buy. This is a horrible generalization. Most properties in most cities in Australia will go up over time, roughly the same amount as each other. Perth might go up a bit more than Melbourne. Melbourne a bit more than Brisbane. Brisbane a bit more than Sydney, or whatever they are. But generally speaking, they'll go up in a roughly. A rising tide will lift all boats, and there's nowhere near that differential there's a much more bigger differential, sorry, in shares than in property. So I think that's it's just, I don't blame anyone saying shares are more complex. They are. Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Shares are take more work. I think it's worth it. That's what you would expect me to say. I'm on this podcast. I've been doing this job for a while. That's a view, mate. But I think that's why. I don't think that's unreasonable, but I think it's a shame.
Yeah. Can I say too, what's surprising is that prejudice or that bias or that view with shares versus property was, again, I really don't try to make this all about me, but just recent experience with applying for a loan and going through all of that. You go up and it's like, yes. You're submitting tax returns. They're looking at your balance sheet. It's like, ooh, there's a lot in shares. Like, yeah. Hey, in FY21, where did all this money come from? It's like, oh, I had a really good year. Sold some shares that year. It's like, yeah, that's we can't look at that seriously. It's like, why not? So, it's nice that you did well, but that's speculative. That's speculative return.
Yeah.
So it's like even for supposedly very financially savvy institutions, that bias exists. Whereas if you have your money invested in shares, you're seen as a degenerate speculator. If you have 12 negatively geared investment properties, you're a prudent long-term capital allocator. It's like, what? And it's just like, well, whatever you think, I can just press a button and turn it into cash. So who cares? Can you imagine what they thought of the Bitcoin? it was so surprising to me from that level of, again, people who should know better, people who are in a listed entity themselves and run some of the biggest exchanges, and you're looking at this stuff as hyper speculative. And that is that, you know, it's whether it be the Wolf of Wall Street or the Big Short or the Wall Street movie itself or Margin Call, great movie, by the way. They all paint and reinforce the picture of shares are gambling. That's what they are. And I get it all the time too. So if I'm talking shares, which I often am, and I've had, I'm telling a story of where I lost money, it's like, well, serves you right. What did you expect? And when it goes well, it's like, well, you got lucky. So I can't win. It's sort of like, it's sort of do bad, get what you deserve, do well, you dodged a bullet and got lucky, but it won't happen again. It just has this taint to it. But as I say, it's kind of like, that's kind of cool, right? I don't have to change the world. If you can recognize it for what it is and see the opportunity that is there, let others have their prejudices and you can just exploit the opportunity that is there. And exploiting the opportunity isn't necessarily having a 12-monitor trading setup. It's just like I just buy an ETF every paycheck. I allocate a little bit to it and you'll have the last laugh.
Yep, I think that's right. But again, why don't other people do it? I don't know we're going to solve that one necessarily. Yeah. Hey, here's a question. I'm not going to mention our correspondent's name only because he's very precise with some of the detail he gives, which I love. But I will do him the... He didn't ask me not to mention his name, but it may be clearer as I read this out. Hi, Scott and Ram. I thought it was time I reached out and thanked you and the team. You and Ram have helped me get to where I am in life and have been masterful teachers. Thank you very much. I'm a chartered accountant provisional, says our correspondent, and have much of my professional success due to your teachings on the podcast, which is a remarkable thing to say. Also, a shareholder member of more than 5 years, he says. You like this, Ram. My firm gets paid an exorbitant amount for me to rephrase the advice given by you and the team when working through complex issues on the podcast. I've also read all
You're
the
welcome.
Books. Exactly. I've also read all of the books you have prescribed through the years. Honestly, I've learnt much of the evergreen business and management principles from the podcast, delivered more succinctly, he says, than a bachelor's degree in accounting, economics, finance, and the chartered accounting program. I'm currently on the other side of a tough time personally. Sorry to hear it. I look forward to the podcast every week, both Friday and Sunday episodes. I use them both to hone my professional skills. And this is mostly why I'm mentioning this one, Ram. You will honestly laugh at the following. I'm age 25. I'm an ultra marathon and Ironman triathlete. Most and all of your business and life teachings transfer to all aspects of life. My summation is the following. The podcast teaches discipline, as in order to save, you have to live within your means. Also, delayed gratification. He also then put some photos in of him buying a house and doing his ultra marathons. So, mate, well done. Very impressive.
Well done.
He says, I've been listening since 2018, back from when I bought my first house. I've had no help from my parents financially other than given a good education and upbringing on the farm. Things you'll laugh at. I also love and own a secondhand Hilux and have a great love for country music, my favourite song being Graham Connor's The Road Less Travelled. So, yes, we have some kindred spirits there, Ray. I just thought it was just a funny...
That's really cool.
A funny message to pass on. Do you have any particular view or feedback on that one?
I don't think you or I have ever come up with an original take.
Exactly.
And here's the big secret. There is no secret. This is all on the shoulders of giants kind of stuff where what does Mungus say? You don't have to figure everything out for yourself, right? And for those that it's I think we've got a good platform here that we can sort of share these ideas, but I just really want to stress the point here that we didn't figure it out, right?
Yeah, like that's absolutely true.
I think everyone starts out at the same. You try and figure it all out. It's all very confusing. There's a lot of noise and fluff and misdirection and stuff that's out there. But you find that whether it's 1990 or it's 2043, the core investing principles never change. Never will change. I mean, maybe the things that we invest in will change and the rest of it, but it's all, and we often sort of joke with each other. It's like, we just keep repeating ourselves here, but it's like, I don't know how else to get around that because as soon as you start introducing new ideas, the old ways are all broken. This is how we do it.
There's no new ideas.
Like, you know, I just like one thing that makes me bristle. You see it in the papers every now and again. It's like long-term investing is dead.
Buy and hold is dead, says hedge fund manager.
Like, hedge fund manager who's 3 years away from blowing themselves up and going off into obscurity, which is usually what happens.
I appreciate
the commentary and that, but it's just sort of anyone who's intellectually curious, you'll find so much great resources out there these days. And if we can help share the message, then great. One day we'll come up with an original take, it hasn't happened yet.
That's false advertising. I will say, mate, speaking of which, again, just some lovely symmetry, our question included some photos, one of which was literally captioned at the top, standing on the shoulders of giants. You used that phrase, which is brilliant. Okay. You haven't seen it? Listen, and I promise you hasn't seen the photo, but yes.
That is cool.
Literally standing on the shoulders of giants as part of the post. So that's kind of fun. Yeah. This one's from Guy. Hi, Captain Scott and Roger Ramjet.
Roger Ramjet. I loved that show as a kid.
When Ramjet takes his noodles roaming off, the crooks begin to worry.
That's right.
Fantastic. Thanks again for all the many hours of interesting content, rants, tangents, and conversational cul-de-sacs, says Guy. In the words of Ram, quote, I'm not sure where I'm going with this. Introduction. I have a question, though, he says, about an old recommendation called Dubba. Recently, Dubba was suspended from the ASX after they reported that, somewhat carelessly, they had misplaced a cool $26 million. I was wondering if you could answer what a suspension means, how long it lasts, and what it potentially means for an investor. Thanks, and keep up all of the great work. And he signs off G-Star. So I've called his guy, but G-Star is how he's referred to himself. So G-Star, thank you. He also says, P.S., when are you bringing the Motley Fool live show to Melbourne? I don't know. We haven't got an answer for that yet, Guy, but I will put that on the list of things to consider. Mate, suspension of shares. Talk us through what happens there.
Well, very quietly, I'm on a public broadcast. couldn't be shouting this. just between you and me. The Dubba story is fascinating. Dubba is that call recording software. So I actually worked in a call center 100,000 years ago, and everything for regulatory purposes, everything needs to be recorded. Every time you call a call center, your message, your conversation will be recorded.
For quality
and coaching purposes. And I would actually argue that not much quality or coaching is going on, because every call center is like one of the inner rings of hell, and I would rather chop my left arm off than ever go through a call center.
It sounds better than so that we can cover ourselves if we ever have an issue.
Yeah, that is exactly right. Yeah. But back in the day, it was little mini cassettes, right? Now, obviously, it's all cloud-based and the rest of it. Dubba, that's what Dubba was doing. And it's a phenomenal, phenomenal history of sales growth and revenue growth. It just had this chart that went from bottom left to top right. Every year they made more and more, and let me use my words carefully here. They generated more and more and more sales. The interesting thing is that there was never any profit. And that's normal in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like you got to spend money to make money, and you're trying to scale the business. There's a structural shift underway in the industry. Like, go, it's a land grab, do what you've got to do. But not only do they never effectively scale, But the losses got wider and wider and wider. Not only that, but the shares outstanding expanded and expanded and expanded. So you could even go back to 2019, they had 186 million shares on issue. Today, it's something like 315 million shares in issue. Right, so there was dilution. Yes, sales are going up, great, but profits were going down. Which was just not the way things are meant to go. You know, eventually you need to sort of see that pivot point.
Yeah.
And then it was announced the other day, the CEO was that their passport confiscated and was restricted from leaving. So they're, I'm going to be careful here for legal reasons.
Say, thank you, yes.
But
allegedly.
There is an inference that, I mean, it's a concern.
Thank you.
It's a concern, is what I'll say.
Good. Yes.
And so, so shares are suspended. What does suspended mean? I mean, by the way, it's just like you can't, the drama, that like truth is always stranger than fiction, right? Yeah, and it's just like there is a movie that could be made here. And again, I'll shut up, but just Google it. You'll find a fascinating story. So the ASX, I mean, to trade on the ASX, you've got to comply with the ASX's rules.
Yes.
And part of those rules are ongoing disclosure, viability of insolvency of the business, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a big question mark over Dubba. And until the ASX can be confident that the market is properly informed, they'll say shares are suspended. And that might, I have seen shares been suspended for years, and I've seen shares suspended for a couple hours. Mm-hmm. So I think it can almost be indefinite. Maybe you correct me on that. But I think it can almost be indefinite until the ASX is satisfied that you meet all of the requirements to trade.
Correct.
And what does it mean? Can't sell your shares. Impossible.
Not on the market anyway.
No. Wow. Good point. You can't. Yes. So I could do an off-market transfer if I could find someone who's prepared to buy my shares, and I can fill out the form. And by the way, you can do that anyway. So you can sell. There's you can't just do it at any price and the rest of it. There are requirements to that. But yeah, effectively you can't trade it. So you're kind of stuck until they resume trade. And when they do resume trade, it might gap down to 10 cents or it might go, if it resumes trade.
I mean, probably really Dubba's case, but there is no guarantee that a suspended share will return to the bourse.
I can't imagine if it does resume that it's going to go up.
Yeah.
It will very likely go down significantly.
I mean, there's a chance that if whatever issues were already known are resolved meaningfully and successfully, maybe it is a case of, hey, we've raised some more money, we've found the $26 million, everything's okay again.
Here it is.
You know, well, yeah, I would say found
it's
it.
Under
they've
the recovered. Mattress. We forgot.
Recovered might be a better word.
Yeah, but
yes,
recovered.
Yes. I'm only saying that you're right, almost certainly will go down. But there is a circumstance where a company is so in such horrible condition, shares get suspended while it fixes itself. It may well come back having resolved some of the problems it had. Again, not Dubba specifically, just a company in general. And that actually might actually improve the share price rather than harming it if the market's convinced that the decisions made were beneficial, for example.
Yep. I would be wary. Look, I can't give advice. The difficulties... I've long said that the key responsibility of management is capital allocation and setting the culture.
Yes.
And... the potential here is that the person sort of responsible for those things I'm having to drink. I would suspect that even if there is a core of a really good business here, turning that around after a potential scandal and like it just no one likes to be associated with a losing team, right? Like if ever you've worked in an institution where it's like that and people turning up because they have to pay the mortgage and whatever, but they are out the second the better opportunity comes and they're just your goal. It's like that movie Office Space. Like my goal here is to do the bare minimum of work to not get fired. That's my incentive. I'm not going above and beyond here. I'm just don't get fired. Just not be the worst person in the views of management. And the reason I say all of this is because, and I've been there before, and I think it's a very common trap for investors is that you loss aversion is super powerful, and you will convince yourself it's not a loss until I sell. It's just a paper loss. Yeah. You can come back.
Yeah.
Well, it's a little bit scary now, but look, it's like it's 10% of the price that it was before. So now it's really cheap and now I should hold on. There are some situations where it's just sort of like pull that Band-Aid off and move on. Yeah. And maybe that's one of these situations.
Yeah, I think that's right. So look, I think we've hopefully answered the direct question. companies get suspended for a lot of different reasons, sometimes their own request, sometimes because the ASX requires them to be suspended. They haven't met what we call the listing rules. And if you haven't done that, then you're in trouble. In this case, yeah, we're obviously waiting for more certainty and clarity. The ASX's job is to hopefully have a fully informed market.
Yes.
And where there's uncertainty or the chance that things aren't fully informed, or there's just new information required, that can cause the ASX to decide not to trade. At a company level, if you're trying to sort stuff out, I've not held shares in a company suspended for a long time, but I've certainly made recommendations where they've been suspended.
In some cases, for me.
We've had capital raisings suspended for that reason.
Can I just emphasize the point you made there before? Because I really took it in the negative direction there. Companies themselves will usually request it.
Mm.
Because they think, okay, something's happened, and our fear is people talk, right? These companies have tens of thousands of people working there, right? Like news gets out, and you don't want that allegation. So as soon as you feel as though there's something that's potentially knowable that's out there, the prudent board will say, hey, ASX, we request a suspension. It gives us time to prepare the information and to put it out there. And sometimes you'll see an article, the AFR has a hot scoop and they put something out there and they're like, okay, we can suspend shares because we want time to be able to properly respond and we want to make sure the market is informed. So I really want to make the point that, and that's why I say it happens all the time. Plenty of shares I own are going to suspension, not for a bad thing, but because the board is being prudent and proactive to sort of say, listen, we're aware of information that's out there that's not evenly distributed. It hasn't come from us in the form of a formal disclosure to the ASX. So we want to make sure that no one can trade shares until we get that out there. And once everyone is on the same page, then we can let shares trade as normal, which is a perfectly appropriate and sensible thing to do.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Here's a question from Jeff. He says, hi, Scott. Feel free to use my name. I recently discovered Strawman, which I understand is an Australian premier online investment club. And it looks terrific, says Jeff. I also love the show, love the banter, and the general education you and Ram provide beyond just investing. It's a great educational tool that teaches/preaches the mindset required to be a successful investor. Good to get contractual obligations out of the way. Good to get contractual obligations and show adulation out of the way, says Jeff quickly.
Here's my knee. Kiss the ring and bend the knee.
Here's my question, says Jeff. The average Australian stock market return over the past 30 years is 9.2% per annum. Mm-hmm. He says, source that wonderful Vanguard compounding index chart. Mm. However, the average superannuation return over the same period is significantly less.
Mm.
And closer to 7.4% per annum. Mm-hmm. What accounts for this difference? I would propose, says Jeff, it is fees and too conservative an investment strategy that most super administrators provide.
Now,
fees are obvious. There's little margin for super providers if investors investly direct in stocks compared to a proprietarily managed super fund. But why would super funds encourage too conservative an investment strategy? Again, I think this is self-interest, as super investors are less likely to notice a small loss made consistently over a number of years compared to a one-off big loss experienced during a market correction, which may cause the investor to go elsewhere with their super savings. The super scheme in Australia is rightly coveted by many other countries, but if you and Ram agree with the above, then isn't this the biggest fraud, or in Charlie Munger's words, he says, embezzlement, to be happening today over vast sums of money, when the best strategy for most super investors is simply to invest their super in a low-cost, broad-based ETF that more closely aligns to stock market returns, which currently most are not? Jeff from Perth. Great question and some good comments and some lovely compliments. Thank you, Jeff, as well. Yep. Ram, is this the biggest fraud being perpetrated today?
I don't know if I would go to that extent, but I share your outrage, Jeff, and you've nailed it. Fees and people trying to protect you from volatility, which is just another way of saying protect you from superior returns.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like you can have good returns and volatility or low returns and no volatility. You can't have both, right? You just can't. It doesn't exist. And they provide it. Look, now we've got to be careful not to personalize this too much because I'm speaking through my lens. if I was 59, well, actually, I don't want. I'm at a point now where it's more about wealth preservation than wealth creation, wealth growth. And so there is actually perfectly appropriate scenarios where you would want less return because I've got to live off this money at this point. But anyone who's more than 10 years out from retirement, 100% equities, 100% passive. The amount of snouts in the trough in this industry, the superannuation industry in Australia has just got, too many people trying to be too clever, creating products that are unnecessary, overly expensive, and not fit for purpose. It's an absolute debacle. And so fraud, I don't know, but it's pretty silly. It's pretty silly.
I want to agree mostly, mate. I'm going to throw a bit of nuance in from my perspective and then come back out to your point, which is I've said before, my mother came to me, years ago now, many, many, many years ago. I think even before I was doing this job, and said, my super fell last year. Isn't it supposed to go up? I'm contributing money to that.
Mm.
And I think to Jeff, just to kind of broaden out your concern or your point, we're dealing with people who have their own needs and objectives and frankly temperaments and experiences. We were asked earlier, why don't more people invest in shares? And we kind of answered that question. And then at the same time, we're now saying, well, actually, if this is the case, where does that kind of leave us, right? And I think this is important because if we kind of, really set it out, there are some people who don't want to maximize their returns on a given over time, frankly, even if they don't know that's true, because they would say, I would rather have a less volatile return, please. Can I please have that? And I actually don't think that's unreasonable if those people want it, right? Particularly if we're giving them the choice of managing super. Now, the bigger picture here is, would it be appropriate, for example, for super? I mean, let's be honest, we don't worry about whether or not the pension's going to be affordable in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years when we retire. But we worry about whether we're going to have enough money. The flip side of giving people control of their own superannuation savings is that they now worry about whether or not the money will be there. The public service sector, the defined benefit fund that used to happen would say you will get this much in retirement. And so people didn't worry about year to year whether the money backing that up was enough, or when the market had a bad year, they didn't think, gee, maybe I won't get my government allocated pension or, defined benefit pension when I'm 66 because the market fell when I was 58. But once we give people a lump sum and say, you manage this, your responsibility, you look at the number, you look after it, the benefit of that is we get to make those decisions for ourselves along the lines you suggested. The cost is plenty of people are like, given the choice, I would rather not know. I would rather if I knew I could trust my superannuation fund, don't tell me. I'll put my money in. Now, they shouldn't do this because they'll get screwed if they do, because there's some horribly, horribly unconscionable conduct and some dodgy people in our industry, unfortunately. But in a perfect world, I would love to think there was a super fund. Let's say the future fund, for example, right? I'm pretty sure, in my view, the default super fund for everybody should be the future fund, administered for a tiny, 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 tiny fee. And to your point, Jeff, invested in ETFs. That should be the default for everybody. And they should know or reasonably have reason to believe they could just have their money go in there automatically. And when they're retired, they'll find out how much they've got and they'll go and get on with their lives. And that would do a very large minority of the population a massive service. Because they don't want to know. They don't need to know. They don't need to be involved. They don't need to do anything with the money. Just give them a really decent return at a very, very low fee for a very long time, and the money will look after itself. I think once you start to, though, give people that control, to your point, mate, the cynical view is, Jeff, I mean, not you, Ram, the cynical point is, hang on, they're getting a subpar return, therefore, it's fraud because the super funds are trying to do what they're trying to do. The more generous, and frankly, I think the more real is, and here's the other problem. Ram and I aren't representative of the general financial advice community. The general financial advice community talks about diversification and spreading your assets, your money across different asset classes. And there's the default My Super. Every fund has to have this default option called My Super, right? And that default is a balanced option. The government makes them. The orthodoxy in our industry, and for regulators, because regulators are generally risk averse, or in this case, volatility averse, though they would believe it's the same thing. They would say, honestly, and with hand on heart, with no regulatory capture, nothing, the boffins would say you should own some property and some cash and some shares and some alternative assets because then you're diversified and whatever. They would say, frankly, and this is sounds stupid to say out loud, but I'm going to. They would say a 7% less volatile return is better than a 9% more volatile return over 40 years, which is madness, right? I represent the Motley Fool. The Motley Fool has a financial services license. I'm obliged to do some continuous professional development. When I answer the questions on that form to show that I'm capable, I have to tick the box which says, yes, of course, you should have lots of different asset classes because that's the right thing to do when you're diversified. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. Now, I could tick the right answer and be marked wrong. Now, I say the right answer. It's my opinion. I could be horribly wrong and horribly arrogant and, you know, heuristic, but I don't think I am. I think the numbers demonstrate it. But the reality is that the industry, I don't even mean the super industry, like the people who are making money here. The financial advice industry believes that a more diversified, less volatile return is better for everybody, not just those who need a conservative approach. There's conservative on top of that, which is even more cash and even more property, even less shares. Balanced is a bit of everything, and they call aggressive shares and international shares, Australian shares, oh, and still a bit of property, a bit of cash. It's madness. It's absolutely madness, Jeff. You're absolutely right. I don't for a second believe it is the industry at large being craven or being fraudulent. I think they are told, they literally are told, your My Super Fund must be the balanced option. That's what they're told to do. That's what you must provide, which is crazy. So, yeah, I think there's a problem with the orthodoxy in the industry, mate. I think I don't think it's super funds doing it. I think the fees are far more an issue, far, far, far more issue than the asset allocation in the context of people doing the wrong thing. I'm ranting. You go.
I just hate the labeling of it because anyone new to the space and you're given a box to tick and you're like, one says aggressive and one says conservative or balanced. Yep. Like, I'm not an idiot. Like, this is my future retirement. Like,
I'm not being aggressive with that.
Conservative, exactly. Thank you. Yep. I don't want to speculate with that.
Yep.
But it's an entirely inappropriate label to use. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not aggressive, you know? Yep. It is sensible, diversified in the biggest, best companies in the world. And to such an extent that it's not even a bet on any single one company. It's like, as long as you believe that in the continued flourishing of the human race and our society, that's a pretty good bet, right? And if not, well, you know, grab a shotgun and a pack of seeds because that's your alternative here. So it's sort of, but when I first got my proper job, I did exactly that. I ticked the conservative box.
Of course you do. Yep.
And it was years later and God knows how much in foregone returns before I thought, wait a sec, what am I doing? Like, no, 100% equities. Thank you. You call it aggressive. You can call it whatever term you want to call it, but it's the absolute sensible option. I would say entirely with a perfectly straight face that if you're 10, 15 years from retirement and you're all in cash or you're all in quote unquote low risk, you're actually taking an insanely high amount of risk, a ridiculously high amount of risk because the risk is almost, it's not even a risk, it's a guarantee that you are going to see your wealth effectively eroded over that period of time. It won't be volatile. It'll be a nice steady easing into financial mediocrity, but you know, that's what you're going to get. Cash is massively risky. Mm. Bonds, massively risky over any length of time because they're just going to be eroded away. So
and risky not in terms of lost value, but in terms of missed growth opportunities.
Missed growth opportunity.
The idea of you could have so much more with that money, you're taking a risk by not having it compound at anything like the rate it could otherwise compound.
Yep. And it's especially if you're like 40 and below, it's not even a question. Tick the most aggressive option you can. It makes you feel like, oh, does this mean that I'm going to be investing in some really high-tech speculative biotechs? No, they just mean equities. They're just equities.
Commonwealth Bank and News Corp and CSL and Telstra.
Again, academics can't distinguish between volatility and risk. And Buffett makes the point again and again and again. One is not the other.
Correct.
So anyway, we've hit that, flogged that horse into oblivion.
We have. Again, I'm going to add, with the exception of those who need the volatility protection from themselves, if you know that's you, then do it because it's going to help you sleep at night. You're not going to freak out. I said, my mother was, you know, is my super fund doing a dodgy here because I lost some money? The market had a bad year. Mm-hmm. And so the
which it does one in every three on average.
Correct. And that's, you have to make your peace with it. The problem is we don't educate, back to the original question, we don't educate people well enough to know what to expect, and that is normal. My mother should have known. If you're, I don't want to be a nanny statist about this, but if you're going to be given your own super fund and told to manage it, or to be responsible for it without being then informed and educated properly as to what to expect. I think we're setting people up for failure, right? The idea of, you know, give every kid a gun and hope they learn to shoot it before they shoot themselves in the foot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not exactly that dramatic, but the analogy is not that far off. Some will be fine. Some will shoot themselves. Some will shoot their mates. You know, there's a point at which you say, can I use the Uncle Ben line?
Yes.
Yeah. With great power comes great responsibility. That's it, right? So, I'm in the financial service industry, right? I'm supposed to say everyone should have an SMSF and do their own thing and come to me for advice. I am reasonably sure there are too many people with SMSFs. Not our listeners, because hopefully they're well informed and know what they're doing. My mother shouldn't have had an SMSF. Her financial advisor made $1 squillion from her and the old man when he was still alive in fees, which was just a highway robbery, and he should be condemned forever for that, just thousands of dollars unnecessarily. But on top of that, you know, honestly, mum was a nurse, dad was a fiery, right? Really wonderful, wonderful people. Couldn't have asked for better parents, but they were financially savvy in terms of household budget stuff, but they didn't know anything about investing. And yet they're told, here's an SMSF, put it with this platform, put it in this wrap, I'll take these fees, they'll take these fees, here you go.
Maybe that's only 2%. It's only 2%. Right? Right. 2% doesn't sound like much. Okay.
Correct. Cool. Every single year for 10 years, that's 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, we're talking about six-figure superannuation balances.
Yeah, 2% of something that's underperforming the index anyway.
That's the other thing, right?
Right.
I'm reasonably sure most people should have a default option, which is, if not government run, run by not-for-profit, with low-cost ETFs, mm-hmm. and told, this sounds really, really paternalistic, and I don't mean it to be, but told, we'll look after it, don't worry about it, keep doing your contributions, mm-hmm. by the time you retire, you'll have plenty. Mm-hmm. That honestly, people shouldn't have to be advised to, be invited to, manage their own super unless they genuinely can show they're capable of it, prepared to do it, can do it successfully. To your point about being conservative, you know, blowing up an SMSF because you made some bad investment choices, it's just, we do people a massive disservice in that context.
Yeah.
You know, put it away, let them come up with 67. Surprise, here's what you got. Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize, I hadn't noticed that over the last 45 years. Mm-hmm. That million dollars, wow, that's amazing. Thank you very much. Mm. No stupid decisions. I'm not saying people can't make good decisions. I'm saying a lot of people can't, shouldn't have to. But we kind of, a bit like property, as we were saying, people kind of assume this stuff. Mm. You're supposed to have an SMSF. You're supposed to run your own super. You're supposed to choose your own fund. Mm. We've set up a system that penalizes people who get it wrong in a million different ways, when the default should be, we'll look after it for you. If you can and want to and know you can and can show you can manage it, mm-hmm. then great. Go on, run it for yourself. I know that's paternalistic. I know people hate it for nanny state-ness, but it's just, you know, again, from personal experience, it shouldn't be something that some people have to deal with unless they want to. And again, that's not everyone on this podcast, because people are listening because they want to, which is great. So I'm not saying people should be stopped from doing it. I'm just saying the default should not be knock yourself out, good luck, hope you do okay.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm going to ask a question which is almost exactly the same question, Ram, but I'm going to ask it directly because Paul's asked it, and I think the answer will be relatively quick and simple and straightforward. Paul simply says, hi, Scott and Ram, hope you're well. It's been a while since I've messaged. I've listened to you guys on the pod for 6 years now. I know you can't give me advice, but just let me know if I'm on the right track. That's kind of the same thing, Paul, but we'll deal with the question anyway.
We'll allow it.
We'll allow it. I think this is a very important question about the younger generation and their super. I wish I'd done this when I was starting out. I'm 55, and I've only just switched my super to, quotes, high risk, exclamation mark. Now, he says, he's got a couple of questions. Isn't this like doing your own portfolio? I know I've had a portfolio with help from you guys, and this is why I swapped to high risk in my super fund, Australian Super. Now, my question is, my kids are just starting out. I'm going to start them out at high risk from the start. Please tell me I'm on the right track. This has been playing on my mind for a while now. Thanks, you guys rock. Now, I think we know the answer, Ram. I think we've just done the answer.
The answer is yes.
So I'm going to ask you a slightly different question, which Paul didn't ask, which is, if he's going to put his kids in high risk,
mm-hmm.
how should he help them understand what he's doing and why, and what they should expect? Because that's the key one, right? There's, in 2 years' time, when the market falls, or 3 years, or 5 years, or tomorrow, mm-hmm. and his kids say, Dad, what the hell did you do? My super's down 15%. Johnny over there is only down 5% because he's got cash and property. Mm-hmm. I can't believe you cost me this money. What does Paul need to do, and frankly, our other listeners need to do, to make sure they put their kids in the right position if they're going to take this path?
Well, it's big picture, right? At some point, you want to retire. And when that point comes, you want to be not eating cat food and wrapped in blankets because, you know, you've got no money, right? You want to enjoy your life. And that means having a low time preference. It means sacrificing some spending now for more spending later. You can't do it in cash because by design, that's going to get to, even if it works well, you're getting 2 to 3% poorer each year. So you got to do something with it. What's the best option? Well, the best option is the one that's going to give you the best risk-adjusted return. The best risk-adjusted return, I mean, I say risk-adjusted, and I've got to be careful to explain that because the best return possible is a Powerball ticket because you're going to turn $3 into $100 million. Like, you can't beat that, right? But it's also very likely that you won't win. So you need to look at the return through the relative risk that you're taking. And it just turns out that, you know, decades and decades of data and multiple different areas around will just show that you know, entrepreneurism and equities is just a wonderful wealth creation vehicle. So that's how we're going to save for our future. We're going to do it through these vehicles because we can't use cash. It's going to be really lumpy because, you know, economies rise and fall, companies fail and get created all the time. But we also know that on average, it tends to be really, really, really well. And you're doing this over a multi-year period. Here's the Vanguard chart. It's going to look probably something like this in another 30 years. I don't know where the peaks are going to be. I don't know where the troughs are going to be, but the general direction is bottom left, top right. So this isn't something to look at day to day, right? This is something to look at, do it, you know. I almost guarantee that if you were to plot your returns where you only put a mark on the chart once every 5 years, there would be no volatility and would only go up. Yeah. And that's where property investors are right. It never goes down. It's like, well, in the way that you're tracking it, it probably doesn't. I mean, if, you know, I bought in 1983, I sold in 2024. And it went up. The volatility is invisible because you didn't measure it at every single day and hour and minute along the way. So that's the answer, right? And it's like, well, you can have a more consistent ride if you want. Just understand that there is a cost to that, and the cost is a far more impoverished retirement. So you choose.
Love it. I can't add much more to that, with the exception of, if the four most dangerous words in investing are this time, it's different. Maybe the three most profitable words are Vanguard index chart. Yeah. So Paul, just, the chart tells the story. No guarantees, no promises, but I think, I can't tell you what you should do or your kids what they should do, but again, as Ram said before, the other question, I hate the phrase high risk, it's stupid. High volatility at best is probably the farthest we should go with it. High return would be nice because that's actually what happens over time, but you won't see that. And look, in the problem is regulators, if you labeled high return, moderate return, low return, regulator probably wrap you over the knuckles like, you can't do that. Because that's just, you know, they're a conservative group who have swallowed the financial markets orthodoxy, which is really bad for everybody. Expect some really stomach churning times. Expect, though, over the long term, some really, really good returns. No guarantees, no promises, but that's certainly how I would talk about it.
Yep. Easiest decision you'll ever make. Like, really, it is. There is very few things that you can be very certain of in investing, but I think that's one of them, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. This is a question, great question from Andrew, mate. Let's get stock specific, or at least stock relevant. Andrew says, "Hi Scott and Rant Page, a question for the mailbag, if I may. I've seen several analysts, including some folks with the Motley Fool in America, say the valuation of certain tech stock darlings, he lists Nvidia, Shopify, Datadog, CrowdStrike, is too high." And they've sold their positions or trimmed them and plan to buy back in when they fall. Isn't this the very definition, says Andrew, of timing the market? I understand not adding to positions when the perceived valuation is too high, but selling seems to run counter to the buy and hold ethos. What am I missing? Thanks, Andrew.
Nothing. I'm missing anything. Bang on. Now, if you get it right, it is the better strategy. If you can sell out before every crash and back up the truck at the bottom of every market, you're going to do far better than the buy and hold investor. You just are. But there are big ifs, very big ifs. I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, but we were speaking about a very well-known Aussie fund, a hedge fund manager, who's outperformed the market for more than a decade. Incredibly smart person.
Outperformed?
Underperformed.
Underperformed, yes.
Sorry, did I say outperformed?
You did.
underperformed.
Underperformed the market. Yep.
You know, and they're going short. They're doing all kinds of fancy stuff. And it's just like, you know, the little old lady who just bought an index fund's done better.
That's right.
So...
it's a beauty of index funds. Honestly, like as much as you know, I pick stocks, but Fair Income, the index funds are a very high bar to clear. Yep. And they should be.
Yep.
Like if you can't beat the market, don't. And if your fund manager or your advisor can't beat the market, tell them to buy an ETF or take your money out and buy yourself an ETF.
Yeah. It's just super easy. So actually forget the question now. I'll pass it over to you.
So talk about timing the market and the
magnificent. Oh, timing the market,
the magnificent seven.
I mean, look, there is, I do it, right? I got to be honest with myself here. I do. I have plenty of time sold down stuff as a long-term investor, as a buy and hold investor. Mm. I like what you say, the buy to hold is a better way of putting it. So the intention is to hold. But if something's 10x and now represents 40% of your portfolio and is on a PE of 300 or something, you know, it's not reckless to rebalance there. It's not because I'm trying to time the market with a view of buying back in later. It's just sort of like I've got finite capital. I'm currently invested in something which I consider to be excessively valued relative to other opportunities and now represents an outsized proportion of, you know, I've got outsized exposure to this. If I was to build a portfolio today, I wouldn't be putting 40% in a company that's this valued as such. I just wouldn't. So I will do things. By the way, it's often not worked out. And I do look back and go, probably overthought that one a little bit.
Same.
But I guess... it feels like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, but I think there is reason in that, in the sense that I'm not, don't try and time the market because you just can't do it. No one can. But if you are making some of these decisions on concerns over quality or valuation or exposure, that's not unreasonable. It's not unreasonable. I don't know. Help me out. What would you add?
So I think I'm going to talk out of both sides of your mouth as well. Andrew, I talk about humans and heuristics before. We create labels to mean things because it helps us, rather than having to explain everything for first principles, we say market timing or we say buy to hold. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I know what that is. I know all the things that go behind that. I know where we come to. I know what happens. By the way, you mentioned Motley Fool in America. I will happily disagree with any of my colleagues. So this will sound like a partial defense. I've not seen the comments you've talked about. I happily would disagree with people in Australia that I work with as well as in the US. So, and the Motley Fool is a, you say some, you're right, because we have no house view. So some will say, I love Nvidia, buy more. Some will say, sell it all, and some in between. So this is not about the company, just because you mentioned it and you're right to mention it, I'm happy to talk about it, but I don't want to come across as defensive or supportive. So I'm going to start with buy to hold, or buy. You say buy and hold. I've turned buy and hold into buy to hold. In other words, I buy with the intention of holding. And where I don't think you should hold is when a company's shares, lots of reasons. If the company starts to suck, that's a good reason to sell. If you have a better place for your money, as Ram said, you should sell. If the company's valuation gets way too high, and I say that specifically, not just a little bit too high, not just fair value, in the ethos of being roughly right rather than precisely wrong, if a company I own looks a little bit expensive, I'm going to say, well, I don't know. I'll give it some time and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it falls, sometimes it goes up more. Sometimes I'm wrong, sometimes I'm right. If I'm right about the company, I try to oversweat the valuation. So buy to hold means buy unless there's a reason to sell, rather than buy and hold regardless. Let's take an example. If I liked Woolies and I bought the shares at $30 and they go to $100 and the earnings don't change, Woolies be on a PE of 60. Great business, wonderful culture, great market position. It's not worth that price. And at some point I've got to say, $200, $500, whatever, pick your number. At some point we all agree, even the best business isn't worth holding at any price. Mm. So buy to hold means hopefully hold it for years unless there's a reason to sell. And I don't think it's wrong for someone who owns Nvidia if they said, gee, I liked it at some price, but now it's gone up fourfold over the last year. And gee, I liked it then. I liked it a bit more now, but I don't like it that much more now. I can't justify the current price at all. It's way too overvalued. I think they should sell. I think everyone should sell. And that's not timing the market. That is responding to an individual company's share price and its potential value, comparing the two and saying, oh man, like I'm not going to. If someone offered me $5 million for my house tomorrow, I'd take the money. Yeah. If they offer me 10% more than it's worth, I'd probably say, no, I don't want to move. Thank you anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's worth, but let's just whatever it is. I'd say, well, no, thanks. They offer me $5 million. I'm like, I'm out. $10 million. I'm like, mate, I will move. I will take you to the bank. I'll buy you a limo. We'll drive down there together.
I hope you move the couch. Yeah,
exactly. Right.
I'll carry the fridge on my back. Yeah.
Yeah. You can have my kids. So that's not timing the market. That is simply taking advantage of Mr. Market's exuberance. Right. So that's not the case. The bit that is market timing, which I think you're absolutely right about, is if you say I will sell Nvidia and then buy back when it gets cheaper, you're absolutely timing the market. Because it may not. And that would be absolutely silly. Now, if you sell because it's too expensive and it happens to fall 50%, you might buy back because you go, well, okay, I'm getting offered a great deal again. Yeah. That's not timing the market. That's just buying shares when they're cheap, selling when they're expensive. That's perfectly fine. I have no problem with that whatsoever. And that's not timing the market in my view. But if it is, I'm going to buy when it's up 10%, sell, you know, buy now, sell when it's up 10%, wait till it falls 10%, buy in again, then sell and buy in. I'm planning to do this on some sort of cyclical basis because I'm assuming the price is going to rise and fall and I'm going to do that. That is absolutely timing the market. Or if it's, look, I think right now the market is at, the all odds is at 8,000 and something points. I think that's too high. I'm selling because it's about to fall. I'm going to buy back in when it gets to 6,000 because I think that's what's going to happen. That's timing the market and that's crazy.
Yeah.
So
And the old saying is the market can remain, even if the market is irrational. Let's say it is.
Yes.
You know, is that the market can remain irrational far longer than you can remain solvent.
Correct.
You know, plenty of people have been screaming at the sidelines that, you know, China is about to crash off for years.
Oh,
and all the data points,
man.
And, you know, it's like, yeah,
COVID,
well,
and yeah,
it didn't.
Yep.
Exactly. Not yet. And maybe you'll be proven right, but it's kind of like at a point now, it's like, well, it's kind of very hard to be proven right because you've been on the sidelines so long and there's so much foregone conclusion. You've often made the point. It's like it could crash to, you know, 20% above where you could have bought. If you
correct. Goes up 30%, crashes 10%. See, yeah. I bought it when the market crashed. Like, well, yeah, but you lost 20% waiting for a 10% reduction.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, I think it comes down to, in my mind, intention and strategy. If your intention is, I'll use my personal one. I intend to buy companies that I think represent good value compared to their long-term potential, right? And whatever that roughly remains right, I will hold those shares. If the shares get horribly overvalued, I will sell them because buy to hold or buy and hold in any circumstance is crazy. Mm-hmm. Again, if Woolies goes to $400 and I'm a buy and hold investor, at some point I'm going to say that's still a stupid price I'm going to sell, right? Mm-hmm. Serving the ideology of buy to hold in the face of evidence of absolute stupid valuations would be madness, right? That is that is cultism and religious faith, not sensible investing. But if it goes from 30 to 35 or to 40 or 45, I'm probably still holding. Now, Andrew may disagree. Others may disagree. But I think, well, look, it's a bit expensive.
No, you don't overthink
it. Right? It's not terribly expensive. I'm happy to hold it. I love the business. I bought it at a cheap price. I'm happy to see it through. Let's keep going. So it comes down to the intention and the strategy you're pursuing. Yes, if someone says, to your point, I haven't read the articles, if they said, I'm selling Nvidia now because I think it's going to fall, and when it does, I'm going to buy back in, that's market timing, and that is madness. And if that's someone that Motley Fool in the US said, I will disagree with them publicly, not to pick a fight, but because it's reasonable to say, I have a view, and I'm not going to bend that view based on whether or not it's held by a colleague. So, yeah, if they said, I'm going to buy back when it happens, they might say, I'd love to buy back if it happens, that's different. Because they're not selling because they're expecting it to fall. They're selling because it's too high. And if it falls, they'll take the opportunity to buy back in. Same again, let's use my house. Let's say it's worth $1 million because round numbers. Someone says, I'll give you five. Yeah, absolutely. I'm taking the money. Do I think it's going to fall? I don't know. I'm just taking the money. If it falls to $500,000 and I get a chance to buy my house back from that bloke, I'm going to do it because it's cheap. And why wouldn't I? Am I timing the market? No, I'm just being opportunistic in both senses. So there's a difference in my mind between those two concepts, and that's where the heuristic kind of catches us. No one should be buy and hold regardless. I also don't think anyone should be timing the market. The nuance between the two is important.
Yes. And yeah, the other thing to remember is that with timing the market, you've got to be right twice.
Yes.
In a row. Like you got to know when to sell and then when to buy back in. So even if you time the market, like brilliant, I sold and the price fell afterwards.
Yes.
One, you got that part right.
Yes.
And this is like, okay, now it's 20% cheaper. I'm going to buy back in. Well, maybe it's going to drop another 90% from there. You don't know. You know. So to get both of those turning points accurate, like statistically, I mean, just ask. Here's a very simple observation. Like, I. said to my kids the other day, I was talking about ghosts. You know, I was like, well, isn't it funny? You know, everyone in the world's got a camera and no one's ever taken a picture of these things. It's just like, it's odd. It's odd. I'd find that surprising. And I also find it surprising with all these people who are supposedly able to time the market perfectly that I don't know any of their names. Like, everyone knows Warren Buffett. Everyone knows Peter Lynch. Everyone knows Charlie Munger. Everyone knows Howard Marks. Everyone knows there's a gazillion famous investors out there. None of them are market timers. So, I don't know. Isn't that odd? Isn't that really odd that we don't know? And I'm sure someone will go, well, there is this one. And there's probably some obscure person who has done it.
Yeah.
Because just with the infinite monkey theorem, like, you know, you put enough monkeys at a typewriter, someone's going to reproduce Hamlet, I'm sure. But it's just like, you're the one in a billion people that happened to be the exception that proves the rule. It just, it's a very interesting factoid that there isn't anyone notable that's out there. And yet every day someone will say, but I can do it. Good for you. You may be the first one ever, but I wish you well. I'm going to stick with this other approach. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. It's interesting. By the way, the reason there's no ghosts is because of the Ghostbusters.
There you go.
That's all I'm saying. There's a reason. The only reason we can sleep at night is because the Ghostbusters are out there and they're keeping us safe, mate. So that's, I disagree with your analogy, though. I agree with your broader point. No, you're exactly right. So I think that's right. There's no, don't be ideological about investing. The money doesn't care how it's made. Mm-hmm. So don't hold stuff just because you said you're a buy and hold investor. Mm. Sell it if it makes sense to sell it. Buy it if it makes sense to buy it. But make each decision on its merits. You're right about being right twice. You mentioned fund manager before. There's a whole lot of fund managers who sold out at the beginning of COVID because they were worried about what might happen next and didn't buy back in because they were waiting for COVID to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And they've lost an absolute squid in absolute dollars, but also they've missed the opportunity. The recovery has been phenomenal. We're now back at all-time highs, right? The loss of not being invested because you're being too clever. I'm going to wait until X happens and assumes you can know what the prices will happen between X and Y.
Mm.
If it doesn't happen, you're in a world of hurt.
No one's that clever.
I reckon we're done, mate. Thank you for spending a bit of time this morning. Thank you for your questions. They are Facebook-only questions this week. Thank you for doing that. If you want to get in contact with us, speaking of Facebook, hit us up, info@fool.com.au. Our member services fools will make sure the emails make their way to me. You can follow us on the Twitter machine. It is still Twitter, as I've said many, many times. Can I say, during the week, Ram, I was tagged. It's funny being iconoclastic, right? People remember stuff. I was tagged by a follower who shared with me Mark Hamill of Return of the Jedi fame and other Star Wars movies, who said, of course it's not X, of course it's still Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And someone did tag me on that one. So if it's good enough for Mark Hamill, if it's good enough for Luke Skywalker, it is good enough for me. It is Twitter. You can follow Andrew there at StrawmanInvest or at Sage_Simeon. You can follow me. Oh, sorry, the other way around, isn't it? At Sage Simeon or at Strawman. Oh, which one is it?
@Sage_Simeon.
There you go. I was right the first time. Yeah. @StrawmanInvest or @Sage_Simeon. Follow me there at @TMFScottP. I'm on Insta at the same thing. Also, I think Mastodon and Blue Sky or something else. But yeah, I'm never there, so don't worry about that one. You can follow us follow me on Facebook too. Facebook.com/ScottPhillipsMoney. Please do send us your questions. We would love to hear them. We would love to answer them next week. We will be back. I'm sure Andrew will be back after his. I'm not sure. You're going to embrace the Iron Man. Have you got inspiration from our question? Have you decided you'll be tackling the Iron Man course next week?
Oh, mate, I mean, of course I will. And that's just the warm-up for the ice climb or whatever the other thing I was doing.
And the freediving.
The freediving, that's the one.
You're a very, very busy man. Until next Friday, Fool On.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.